wrote TV to movies. Movies just this year was pretty much dominated by Disney. They have the top five highest grossing movies worldwide with, what's the list? How's it go? Captain America, Civil War. Let me see the exact order. Captain America 3, Finding Dory, Zootopia, Jungle Book, Rogue One. And then in the top 15, they have Doctor Strange and Moana. So they pretty much took over. And Rogue One will gross $1 billion by the end of the week. Or by the time you hear this episode, has already grossed $1 billion. So yeah. But the big movie that I want to let someone talk about, because they missed talking about it when we first did it, and he was very upset and boycotted the show for a number of months. So Thomas really wants to talk about Deadpool.
Okay.
So Thomas,
let me take you back to the release of Wolverine Origins, X-Men Wolverine Origins. Ryan Reynolds is cast as Wade Wilson. I'm like, yes, yes, this is perfect. Ryan Reynolds is going to be an incredible Deadpool. But you know what they do? They sew his mouth shut. They give him laser vision and swords that come out of his hands. Like, what is that? What is that? The two screenwriters go on to create Game of Thrones. So obviously they had an epiphany somewhere, you know, between then there and Game of Thrones. But still, seriously, come on. So then, you know, the thing is, Ryan Reynolds would have been a good Deadpool, and everybody keeps talking about it for years. Everybody's like, you know what? Ryan Reynolds could have been a good Deadpool. Taylor Kitsch, not a good Gambit, but neither is Channing Tatum, but that's a whole different, you know, conversation. So it keeps going, and Ryan Reynolds, like, keeps going along with it when in interviews and stuff. He'll be like, I could have been a good Deadpool. If it had been a good movie, I could have been a good Deadpool. So then somewhere along the way, everybody starts saying, you know what? Ryan Reynolds is going to be Deadpool. It's going to be a movie. And it just starts in the dark corners of the internet, and it starts growing, and it starts growing. And then there's test footage, and then Ryan Reynolds leaks it, and everybody loves it. And Ryan Reynolds won't admit that he leaks it, but he totally did. And then it becomes a movie, and then it's amazing. I'm there opening night. I'm looking at the poster right here that I had signed, the customized poster from my comic book store. And I loved it. And then the guys one day are like, hey, we're going to record an episode. And do you want to be on it? And I was like, I'm sorry, I'm at work. What are you guys going to talk about? And they're like, oh, we don't really know. We don't really have a topic. And then, the next day, Brandon's like, oh yeah, so we did a Deadpool episode. And that's
for the record, I don't want to be included in this group because I don't think I was on that episode. So
you weren't.
Yeah.
It was Ben, Will, and me. And it just delved into a Deadpool episode because I had just watched Deadpool, and then you and I went to go see Deadpool together again. Yep. But you were very upset for a few days.
I think I boycotted the show for like a month.
You could say that. Like, I mean,
you're still in group text.
Yeah, you're still in group text.
I can never get away from the show. You can never escape.
You can't. It's going to be in your notifications every day, whether you want it to or not.
With 70 text messages. So, to go off Deadpool, because I want to ask you this, is what do you see the future like for R-rated superhero movies?
I mean,
because that's what everyone's talking about now.
It definitely showed that there's an audience for it. I mean, obviously, I think that should have been common sense, if you look at the demographic.
Dude, it's the highest grossing R-rated movie of all time. It passed Passion of the Christ.
Oh. Yeah. There we go.
It's insane.
So, yeah. And a lot of people were really worried right after it came out that it was going to make everybody think that they should make R-rated comedy superhero movies. But then Wolverine, Logan got amped up to an R-rated, and the trailer came out, and it's obvious it's going to be a very dark film. So I think the future of R-rated superhero films, I don't really think we can pin that on Deadpool as much as we should pin it on Logan, because Logan's going to show us in any kind of like film trend. I think it's more about the second film to do it than it is the first. Kind of like, you know, when, just to really quick take a detour, I know we said we weren't going to talk about this too much, but kind of like when Batman vs. Superman came out and everybody was like, okay, well, like, maybe let's give Suicide Squad a chance, DC's going to pull it out, and then Suicide Squad came out, and now everybody realizes that DC superhero movies are garbage.
There's definitely a bias here, by the way.
If I could take that for just a second, that's actually my worst of the year. was the DC entries into their movieverse. I feel like we're broken records almost, because it seems like every other episode we bring it up. But it's true,
it's a huge part of the year. It really is.
And Batman Superman is a garbage movie. It's just bad. I mean, that great article someone wrote for us a little while back about how to fix Batman versus Superman. I mean, it was great. It was an excellent...
Yeah, Robbie.
His points were solid. It's a bad movie. And people that defend it, I think, are defending it from... They have to have it be good for them to function as human beings and as fans of something they love. Which I can understand that to a point, but at the same time, though, I also know when a movie is bad. Like and the same thing with and we mentioned again Suicide Squad. It's just not a good movie. There's a movie in there somewhere, but they're just off. That was my worst of the year. I'm just going to go ahead and just throw that out there. The DC entries this year were awful. Here's hoping that Wonder Woman is halfway decent.
But if you believe the anonymous letter from a fired DC employee,
it's true.
Might not have the best hopes for Wonder Woman either.
I know, but that's why hope is terrible, right?
You
know, screw what Obama says. You know, hope's the worst thing. You know,
billions are built. Hope, hope. You know,
I was just gonna say that.
Hope's the worst, right? Like, you know what word you never hear after without in the context of the word dashed?
Dude, it would have been almost better if you could have turned around really quickly and somehow CG'd your face to look like Princess Leia.
And so,
I could do it.
That was a bit of Norm MacDonald there from one of his stand-up specials, but anyway.
It's fine. So, I like Norm MacDonald.
So I want to bring it back to what Thomas said about Logan with Deadpool. I agree with that statement that, like, it depends on what the second one does, because it's not just, like, lightning in a bottle or whatever. It's like, is there actually a trend that you can say, hey, they want to see R-rated movies or superhero movies outside of Daredevil and the Netflix stuff with Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. They want to see it in a theater. So that'll be, and the trailer for Logan looks great. So I'm very interested to see what happens with the actual movie.
This is looking ahead, but I think my big hope for Logan is that they in giving Mangold, right? I always get Ponsolt and Mangold up. Mangold.
Okay.
The director. And giving him like the R-rated leeway, I hope they give him a little more creative leeway on this one, because you could tell in The Wolverine, you could tell that he had a lot of say in most of the film except the third act. The third act just kind of turned into your same old Fox X-Men movie. I really hope, in giving him the like R-rated leeway, I really hope they also give him, you know, the creativity to make this the Wolverine film he wants. Because I really like the first two acts of The Wolverine, the last standalone film.
Yeah.
But that's not 2016. That's 2017 stuff. So.
Yeah.
I got a movie trend that I noticed in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Directors, like big name directors, having really terrible years.
Elaborate.
Examples?
Spielberg, Allied. I don't want to say it, but Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, guys.
Ang Lee.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's a thing. Deepwater Horizon. I mean.
What? Okay, to go on this trend, because I've seen two of those four movies, and I'll defend Deepwater Horizon, and I'll defend Allied, because they both, I thought, were really good movies. Allied, I get if someone doesn't like. I thought Deepwater Horizon was actually a really well-done movie, and I think it's kind of divided into halves, because the first half is kind of like this, like, almost thriller in a way, like it's this mystery, and then the last half is just an intense, like, we have to get off this oil rig, and... To me, in all honesty, the behind 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is another one that we can talk about, that's probably the most intense experience I've had in a movie was Deepwater Horizon for the last half. So I thought it was a well-done movie. It just probably didn't make that much money, if I had to guess, because it didn't do well in the U.S., to my knowledge.
The BFG was a flop. Snowden was a flop.
Hunter, Hunter, I'll see your big directors who are expected to do well and flopped, and see you a successful director who is not expected to do well and did. Tyler Perry, Boo, A Madea Halloween.
Dude, I could have told you right now that Boo Madea Halloween is hilarious based on the trailer.
The last two Tyler Perry movies hadn't made as much money, and everybody thought he was in a decline. They thought he was like, I mean, his TV has been doing really well. I read a lot of articles that were like, Tyler Perry needs to stick to TV. And then Boo Madea Halloween comes out and blows it away and stays in the top five, like, long into November after Halloween.
He just bought an old military base in Atlanta and built it into his own studio and has the old studio. Like, the dude is a machine and will turn out stuff no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
For the foreseeable future. He's not going anywhere. Like,
I know some people that that acted on one of his older shows way back in the day when he first started, and they said they'd do like 2 to 3 episodes a day. Like, they would just like get it out, they churn them out like that, because they'd be shit on TBS.
It's a machine. I mean, it's like not to talk about Alabama football or anything, but it's like Nick Saban's program, dude. It's like he's constantly turning stuff out. I mean,
it's like Clemson's football program?
You mean that pick play you had to win the game? Or how about the three that you had on that drive? We can get into it.
Moving on. So I agree with a lot of that. It's been a rough year for a lot of directors. I think another one, a couple more to bring up, you really haven't seen what's happened with them, is Live by Night with Ben Affleck, who didn't get a good reception when it came out.
Justin
Kurtzell. I'm going to see it next week. I'm still holding out hope. I'm gonna see it anyways.
What'd you say, Thomas?
Justin Kurtzell. He's the director coming off of an incredible Macbeth. Was hoping for big things.
Oh, yeah.
Was hoping for big things out of Assassin's Creed and dropped the ball.
And that reminds me. I made an earlier statement on one of the other episodes, on the video game episode. I said that I thought Assassin's Creed could be the Batman Begins for video games. I was dead wrong on that. It's not going to happen.
It was more like the Batman versus Superman.
You actually said that? I'm sorry. I missed that episode.
I did say it because I thought with the people, with the director, with the creative team. And with Fassbender, I was like, this could be and the way it looked, this could be the one that brings that genre out of like the doghouse, and it didn't do it. And so that's the sad thing.
It's going to take a Halo movie, dude. It's the only way.
Peter Jackson.
I don't ever think it'll happen, but I hope.
No. So off of the, if it came out like 5 years ago, it'd been better. It thing would have been a lot better. So off of that, with the directors and the top people, Anna, I know you have a couple of documentaries and independent stuff you want to talk about.
Well,
bring us some culture, Anna.
Am I the culture person in this group? Is that what I'm here for?
You're one of them.
I just don't want to go into Alabama football and Clemson rant for the next 10
minutes. I can't really contribute to any of that. I wasn't really sure actually what kind of sport you were talking about earlier, so I'm glad to know it's football now. Well, if we're still talking about good directors who've had bad years, this also works into my doc things that I like. But Werner Herzog had one of the worst movies I've ever seen this year with Michael Shannon. Like, he had, like, a star in it, and it was called Salt and Fire. I don't know if any of you guys saw it, but, Salt and Fire. It was totally garbage. It was kind of, like, a companion piece to his Into the Inferno, which is actually a documentary about volcanoes. And then Salt and Fire was also a movie about a volcano, but it was, like, a surrealist kind of ridiculous narrative film. So it wasn't a documentary with Michael Shannon, and it was just... totally disjointed. Michael Shannon read his lines as if Werner Herzog had written them. I mean, he has a very weird way of writing and talking, and so it was very awkward. That was a real letdown. Mm-hmm. But for docs this year, I think it's been a really good year for docs, especially because I feel like Netflix has really kind of brought life back to docs, which is really incredible. I mean, here in Toronto, we have Hot Docs Film Festival, which is a really big documentary film festival, and that's where I see most of these docs that never get representation anywhere. Like, they're amazing, but they only see festivals. But the documentary Tickled, I don't know if you guys saw that, but it's been getting a lot of exposure this year about these, like,
Thomas wants to talk about that, I know.
So like, I saw that at Hot Docs and I was like, oh, this is great, I got to see it now because it'll never be shown anywhere else. and now it's like actually getting distribution. And you know, Amanda Knox just got on Netflix as well. A bunch of Werner Herzog things have come back on Netflix. I guess this is mostly turning into a thing about Netflix again. But I'm just really thankful that they're actually paying attention to docs, because people are actually getting all of their doc content now from Netflix, because there's really no other way for them to see it. I mean, I go to a theater that's specific to docs, but otherwise I would never see them. Yeah, so sorry, Thomas, you've got things to say about Tickled.
Yeah, I just I saw the trailer for Tickled and it was really bizarre, and I went to go see it with some friends on like the cheap night at Sundance Cinemas. It's like $5, and it was after at the New Art, which is the theater near Brandon's house. It was after the director had been like accosted by the subjects of the film at a premiere screening, and I heard all the fallout about that, so I was really interested in seeing it. And then I saw the film and I absolutely loved it. It was hilarious and thrilling, and like I was laughing and I had this moment where it made my heart race. And then after it was finished, we were all kind of getting up to leave, and this employee comes in with a stool and puts a stool down in the front and a microphone, and the director and star just kind of walks in, and we had no idea that he was coming or anything. And he kind of walks up front and he goes, "Hey everyone, thanks for seeing the movie, thanks for sticking around. I've been wanting to do a Q&A because a lot of people have questions after the movie about what happened, but I can't announce I'm doing a Q&A because they sent, like, the Tickled people send their army to harass me anywhere I go." And so he did this Q&A and he stayed behind and talked to everyone afterwards. It was amazing. But yeah, I think it's bizarre and it's interesting, but I think it's also very poignant because it's a story about bullying, which is a big topic, I think, in 2016, and I'm sure we'll be going into 2017. It's just kind of big, powerful people who enjoy bullying other people. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm really glad to hear it is getting distribution, because as of the Q&A with the director, the culprit had not been held responsible yet. And I think the only way at this point, they've exhausted like all legal ways to have him be held responsible. And I think the only way to really bring this to the light is to have a lot of people see this movie and to realize what's going on. Because it's not like an epidemic or anything, but it is something that has really hurt a lot of people's lives. And it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And
yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that film.
Yeah.
I still need to watch it because that was playing near me. And that was something I wish I would have seen when it was here. Some more indie stuff that I think, Will, you can talk about, because I think you wrote something for it, and that's The Witch.
Yes, one of my favorite movies from early in this year. I love that movie. I don't care what the quote-unquote hardcore horror fans say. I don't think it's scary. It's a great movie in and of itself. I don't think you could even characterize it as a horror film. I think I even said in the review at the time that it's not really a horror movie. It's a folk tale, and it's a very dark folk tale, mm-hmm. and it's an incredibly claustrophobic film, and it's wonderful. And everything about it I like. There's not a single... funny story, I went and watched that movie 3 times in theaters, got the Blu-ray when it came out, and when it also came to Amazon Prime Video, I downloaded it to my phone so that during my lunch breaks I could watch, have something to watch during my lunch breaks, and watched it again during my lunch at work. So I like that movie a lot. And Eggers has a huge career in front of him, I think, and especially with this new Nosferatu movie that he's supposed to be doing, I'm pretty stoked for. I was really impressed by, to me it felt like watching, if Stanley Kubrick were still alive and making a movie about a New England folktale, that was what The Witch was to me. Like if Stanley Kubrick was making another movie, just the care and the attention to detail of it all, the natural lighting effects. It's in the horror pantheon of, this is what we mean when we say you can make a movie that's quote unquote scary, but it's actually about something, has character mm-hmm. development and incredible acting.
And what I find interesting about The Witch is that it was very much this atmospheric piece and not just like thrills or scares or whatever. And I know a lot of, because I know one of our writers, Jason Kaufman, wrote about it, how a lot of kind of horror fans were turned off by it. And so that was the, like they hated that one, and then the one the year before was It Follows. They didn't like as well.
That was another great film.
Yeah, I thought it was great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then another one I know Anna wanted to talk about was Neon Demon, correct?
Yeah, Neon Demon.
Neon Demon
was amazing. Nicholas Winding Refn, people, you either love his movies or you hate his movies. There's just really no in between. I mean, the year that Brandon and I were at Cannes was the year that Only God Forgives came out. And that one, people left during the premiere. People were booing it. You know, the whole festival, all anyone could talk about was this horrible movie, Only God Forgives. And I think that really he's just like an atmospheric director, Nicholas Winding Refn. It's all about the kind of how he treats just the universe around him. It's not necessarily about the story. I mean, there wasn't much of a story in Only God Forgives, but Neon Demon's a little bit more. I mean, it's all about, you know, the vices of Hollywood and vanity and, you know, all that good stuff that comes along with Hollywood fame and acting. I just think it looks incredible. That's what I love most about his movies. They're, you know, neon saturated. They're so beautifully shot.
Mm-hmm.
Elle Fanning was amazing in it, I thought. I always forget her name. Is it Jenna Malone who was in Neon Demon?
Jenna Malone.
Yeah, I thought she's incredible. I love her. She's so frosty and brilliant. I loved it. It definitely doesn't get the attention it deserves, I don't think. I mean, have you guys encountered other people who actually like Neon Demon? Because I feel like I'm the only person. I know you like Neon Demon.
No, I liked it a lot.
I mean, every time I try and talk to somebody about Neon Demon, they're like, oh, that movie sucks.
Most of the people I talked to about it were like mad. I ran into some friends coming out of a screening of it, and they were just upset that they had paid money to see it.
That's generally the reaction I also felt from people. I just straight up enjoyed it. It was one of those movies, it's like I wasn't even bothered so much about what the plot was. I was just like, no, I just really love the vibe of this movie.
But it's ridiculous, and it's ridiculous on purpose. I mean, I really enjoyed that movie too. That's another one of those I downloaded immediately to Amazon Prime when it came available, and watched that at lunch at work one day in my car. But I agree with you, Anna. I mean, that's another one of those movies that, because someone asked me if I'd seen Only God Forgives, and I hadn't seen it because I wrote a pretty positive review for Neon Demon. But everything you mentioned in that film, it's true. But the funny thing to me about it is I think a lot of people miss the point when they're watching the thing, because it's ridiculous because it's supposed to be ridiculous. The whole modeling idea is ridiculous. The whole idea of vanity and beauty is everything is ridiculous. And the fact that and I mentioned it in the review that I put up on Medium a while back. To me, it was also it's more of a stronger critique of anything, the pornographic industry in California than anything. It's actually just the way it feels, it's shot, and the whole story matches much more sort of a journey into the pornographic realm. And even the shot sometimes itself lingers a little too long on the erotic, and then it just gradually becomes more and more depraved as it goes along. That was, I thought it was an incredible experience. Totally. And again, it's not for everyone. You're going to have kind of a strong stomach to take it. But I really enjoy that movie.
I always forget about this, but one of my favorite performances of the year was actually Keanu Reeves in that movie. I always forget how much I loved him in that movie. Obviously, his character takes a very horrible turn. But I think the way they set him up is kind of more of a comedy break in the beginning of the film was just totally brilliant. Using Keanu Reeves was so unexpected, and just it was a great kind of break in the movie, I think. I just love Keanu Reeves and everything. I'm so excited for John Wick 2. I can't stop talking about it. So
I just watched Point Break again.
Oh, did you?
Like last week. Oh my god, it was great. It's so good.
It's a brilliant movie.
The movie that came out this past year?
Thomas.
No.
Don't be that guy.
Yeah. That's a great movie.
I mean, if it wasn't so, Thomas, it was going to be me. I was going to be that guy for a second there, so.
Dude, the movie's just so good, man. It's just so good.
It's good.
You can't, that's classic.
True, but like, I feel like everyone always like goes to like Point Break as Keanu Reeves' like best thing, and I'm just like, Speed's
phenomenal.
Speed is
pretty good.
I watched Speed, I've probably seen Speed like, I don't know, 20 times in my life, because my mom is obsessed with this movie, so I've watched it a lot. But I like it more than Point Break.
I'll see your Speed. I will raise you Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Party,
dude! Are we gonna have a Keanu Reeves episode coming up? Because I'm down.
Can we? Because that dude has range. I watched Much Ado About Nothing over the break. He played.
No.
Okay. Did I strike a chord here?
Denzel's brother.
Continue. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. No, but it was upsetting because I love that movie, but he's the worst part about that movie.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's what...
Okay, yeah, no.
That was so
he's
painful.
Terrible.
Yeah,
he's terrible.
Okay. I thought the way you were talking, I'm like, you're about to say, I just watched Much Ado About Nothing. He was phenomenal in it. Like,
no.
Dracula?
No, don't do that.
No. He needs to choose his parts properly, but when he's good in a movie, he's really, really good.
I know, Kung Fu. Okay, so off to Keanu Reeves' Love Fest.
Right.
What else do we have on our dock for the night? So one thing, because I think I don't know if Hunter has seen it, but I know most of us have, and we'll talk about it later for the Oscars. But La La Land's kind of the big talk of the industry right now. Mm-hmm. I know.
For sure.
Hunter, have you seen that?
I haven't seen it. Girlfriend saw it. Said it was great.
Okay. So I think everyone else loved it here, but me. But feel free to, we'll talk about it. So, Will, what were your thoughts on it?
I'd rather hear what you didn't like about it.
Yeah, so
tough. Yeah. That's the thing that's tough, because I was talking to Thomas tonight, because we saw 20th Century Women, which, by the way, I thought was phenomenal. I loved it. Really funny, great acting. But we talked about it afterwards. I was like, or before, La La Land, I like parts of it. It was one of those movies where... I can't really tell you what was wrong with it. It's just it didn't hit me the way it hit other people. And maybe because a lot of my friends said they liked it was one of the best movies they've seen. They always followed up with like, but I'm not a big musical person, a musical like movie fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized I think it's more, it plays better with the non-musical fans because a lot of my musical fans don't like it.
I totally disagree with that. I'm a huge musical fan and I...
You're the only one that I know.
I think it depends on what kind of musicals you're talking about here. If we're talking like Broadway musicals, then maybe not. But like the whole idea of having like a dance, a long extended dance sequence to express your emotions at the end of the film mm-hmm. is so like Gene Kelly mm-hmm. or yes. even The Red Shoes and mm-hmm. and I. When they went off on that, I just went, "Oh my gosh, nobody's done this in decades!" And I love the last 20 minutes of American in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, and that's the type of thing that I think it's more as opposed to like a musical. I think it's more of a dance movie. Like it's more of a Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire type thing, where those guys could sing, mm-hmm. but it was more about their dancing and the musical performing.
And see, when I'm talking, those are the musicals I love, and I agree with that. It just something about it just didn't. I think the last major sequence in the movie I think is great, and my favorite part of the movie is the last like the epilogue type thing or whatever. Something just didn't hit with me, and maybe I always kind of chalk this up to this is that maybe I was too hyped about the movie because I pay attention to it throughout the entire year of it. Getting like the festival release and then everyone loving it and then I go see it and it's like it was okay. So I could be wrong. I could watch it a year later and love it, but I guess it just didn't hit home for me the way it hit home for everyone else. And I can't really tell you the problems with it, because usually if there's a problem I can spot it. There really wasn't a problem to me. It just didn't hit me the way it hit other people.
Well, but, I mean, I'm not going to say it's the most poignant thing I've ever seen, but it was fun.
Yeah.
Like, I had fun watching it.
Well,
I agree. Go ahead.
I think it's more of like what you're saying resonates with me, because I felt like it was more of an experiential film, because I walked in and I was mm-hmm. watching it, and I, for some reason, couldn't watch it critically. I kept like trying to like pick out things that were standing out to me, and I couldn't, because I was totally swept off my feet. I was totally delighted by it, and afterwards I could barely even like, you know, form thoughts about it, because I was just like, no, I just like loved it. I feel good. I feel so happy right now. It was really just like hit me in that way. So I wasn't really focusing on the plot or how it was filmed or anything like that really at the time. I was just focusing on how I felt while watching it. And maybe that's kind of the thing about the movie, and that it didn't hit you in that way.
To kind of go off a topic or a statement that was said by like Denzel Washington, when they asked like how do you think people will feel about the movie, and he goes, it depends on what they bring to it. So a lot of times I could just been in the wrong mindset, in all honesty, of when I saw it, because I remember how I was that day when I saw it. So I will definitely revisit that one, because I kind of felt the same way about Manchester by the Sea. I thought it was really great, but it didn't blow me away like it blew everyone else away. But with La La Land, to talk about this a little bit, because it is the big Oscar contender. I like your topic you brought up, Anna, in our Google Doc, about La La Land versus The Artist.
Yeah.
And so what are your thoughts on that?
So it was just like, I was thinking about, you know, when the Oscars come around and we see La La Land and we see Moonlight go head to head. And I was thinking about, you know, what would it be like? I mean, my personal preference is for Moonlight to win, because I think it's topical and it's beautiful. And I think it's just a all around kind of perfect film. But I also love La La Land, but I didn't feel like it was, kind of deserving of that best picture place. And it made me think about The Artist and how they're very similar films, in that they're both about, you know, dreamers in Hollywood, and how they're both about people who have these like these big dreams, and they're kind of starting from the bottom and kind of adapting, and they're obviously both very much rooted in Singing in the Rain. They're so similar, and it just made me think about how we don't talk about The Artist anymore. People don't bring it up. It's not a relevant film anymore, except for the fact that it's, you know, the last best picture to be in black and white, and, you know, a bunch of other things. But otherwise, I mean, it was so talked about in 2000, I guess it was 2011, and now it's just an obscurity.
I had a moment. I think partially I love The Artist, but when you watch The Artist, it's a Star Is Born, which is a story that's been told 10 times, 20 times maybe, and is going to be told again very soon. And I had this moment when I was watching La La Land where I was like, this is going to be a Star Is Born, and then it wasn't. And I think that's one of the things where The Artist is, this is a really weird reference to make, but it's kind of similar to Avatar. Like, it's a story we all know, but it was brought to us in a different medium, and it was really interesting to see it brought in that medium, but I don't know that it's going to last, because it wasn't a new story and a new story experience for us.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It was for the time of when it was happening, I guess. It was this throwback thing. And that's what I think could help La La Land with, like, Best Picture, is that it's this throwback to, like you kind of said, to the 1950s and Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire. Mm-hmm. And Oscars tend to like that a lot. So Will, did you have a comment on the movie as well?
Yes. La La Land is a perfect movie. which is why you couldn't find anything wrong.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Because, yeah. And here's why. You're right, it is an experiential film. But at the same time, though, to me, the message of the film and its earnestness and its honesty with people that... And again, to sum up the whole movie, this is why I didn't write an article for it, because all I would do is post a link to the audition song with Emma Stone's singing Here's to the Ones Who Dream, and that would just basically be the whole review, because that is the movie. That is the whole point of the movie, that's the whole purpose of that movie, is summed up in that song. But the thing that I love about La La Land is probably the thing that... Because when I watched it in theaters, it was a Monday afternoon, I think. Monday evening. Mm-hmm. And it was packed out, mostly with senior citizens, and I was like, I was probably the youngest person there by a good maybe 20 years, and it was a full theater. And when I left, I heard a lot of folks saying, you know, that movie was pretty good, but I hated the ending. The ending was awful. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be like, what movie were you watching? Because the ending to La La Land is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's quite frankly the movie that it's the ending that we needed to have for this movie, because like you mentioned, Brandon, the last 20 minutes are fabulous, especially that little montage you get. That montage is the ending that everyone, and this is the movie that everyone thought that this was going to be. If it was going to be a quote unquote classic traditional musical, then that's what you would have seen. You would have seen them kiss when they first meet. Mm-hmm. You would have seen them run off together, have kids together. You would have had that. But that's not the story they're telling. They're not making that movie. They're making this movie about people who have dreams and who want to be artists, who want to actually do something. And the way they happen to tell the story is in the film medium, A, something I love, and B, using a format that hasn't been utilized that much to great success or fanfare over the last 20 years, other than Chicago. So when we got that, and you get this heartfelt story, and it truly is a love story, that's one of the things about it that was so, it was so moving. I actually teared up a little bit during the audition song, being perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I truly loved about it is I love when it's whimsical, but it's not too whimsical. It's nostalgic, but it's not too nostalgic. And its use of lighting and use of place, that La La Land itself, L.A. does take on a magical quality to it. It is a place where dreams can sort of happen, and it happens randomly. And they did such a masterful job mm-hmm. with it. That's why, to me, it's a perfect film. It's why it'll get a lot of buzz. I don't think it'll win everything. But I do think it'll be a strong contender because it is so lighthearted, and it is about show business, and we love how much Hollywood likes to celebrate mm-hmm. itself.
One thing that you just said that I want to go off on, because I was at a screening of it in L.A., and there was a Q&A afterwards with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, and they talked about how with the movie, and it was done by Damien Chazelle, where all the major players were people who actually weren't from L.A., and it was kind of this outsider perspective of how LA was like from the people who aren't from there. And they kind of have this dreamlike quality. And I find that interesting. It kind of goes with what you're saying, I feel. So to try to wrap this up quickly with the movie section. So what was y'all's favorite, like his favorite movie or top two favorite movies of the year? So Thomas, you go first.
Favorite movie of your hands down, I've told everyone this, and I think I even called it when I walked out of the first screening I saw of this, and then turned around and saw it again in theaters that same week, but Hunt for the Wilder People by Taika Waititi. Mm-hmm. I was so excited for that movie because I've been a big fan of Taika's for a while. I got to see What We Do in the Shadows last year, and mm-hmm. like was telling everyone to watch it, and then knew that he was picked to make the new Thor movie, and then found out kind of surprisingly after Sundance. I was reading The Best of Sundance and realized that he had done this little film that he had been working on for a really long time, and he just had never really found the right conditions to make this movie, and then all of a sudden met Julian McCullough, who's the main character, who's this just really precocious, incredible child actor, and just realized that all the conditions were perfect to make this movie right before he got carted off into the Marvel machine to make Thor. So what you have is, I think, Taika's best film and the easily the best movie of the year, in my opinion, which is this just hilarious, sweet, sometimes sad, but just overall beautiful film about a man and his adopted foster child who he doesn't really like that much, but they end up they realize that neither of them have any ties to society and go just decide to live in the woods, and it ends up child services is coming after the kid, and it turns into this like manhunt, and it's that Taika Waititi thing is he cares so much about his characters. It has this kind of like whimsy to it that's almost similar to a Wes Anderson film, but in this way that it, instead of that kind of coldness that Wes Anderson has sometimes, it's like the exact opposite, and it's just warmth for every single person involved in the movie. And it's hilarious. Sam Neill is incredible. It's one of his best roles I think he's ever had. And Rachel House is amazing in it, and she ended up, I think she's one of my like MVPs of 2016, because she ended up being the grandmother in Moana and just absolutely killed it. A lot of there's a couple people from the cast of Hunt for the Wilder People who ended up in Moana because Taika Waititi works with a lot of Pacific Islanders, and he also wrote the very first draft of what Moana ended up being. And I think he had a great year, because What We Do in the Shadows, even though it came out a couple years ago, I think it really hit like cult status this year, and he's starting to build a lot of momentum towards his Thor movie. So I'm really, 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 really hoping that turns out well. But yeah, anytime anybody asks me my favorite film of the year, it's easily Hunt for the Wilder People. I've seen it 5 times now, and I still enjoy it so much.
Oh gosh. Do you own it yet on Blu-ray?
I do not own it. I don't know now if that when it first came out on physical Blu-ray and DVD, they did not print enough. This is really rare, but they did not print enough for the demand in the United States, and it completely sold out on Blu-ray and DVD in America. So there was a while in like late November where you just couldn't get a copy of it. And I imagine they've probably done a second printing since then. I haven't really looked, but I do want to own it at some point. But I've rented it from iTunes like twice now, just to watch. But,
so you might as well buy it.
Yeah. I'm going to buy it at some point.
So Anna, what was your favorite of the year?
Well, we've already talked about it. But my favorite movie of the year is definitely The Witch, which I thought was pretty surprising looking back at my favorite movies of the year. But because I'm not actually much of a horror movie person, but I suppose apparently it's not much of a horror movie according to horror movie aficionados, which I wasn't really that aware of either. But I just think that movie is absolutely brilliant on so many levels. It's just shot so incredibly beautifully. The script I thought was absolutely incredible. I know the director actually took language from writings at the time, so it sounds almost real. And that's the interesting part about The Witch, is it all feels very authentic, even though we really don't have much idea of what really actually is supposed to be authentic for the 1600s. But it really does feel real. And one of my favorite things about The Witch is actually also the score. And I actually had the chance to meet the composer for The Witch, and he was talking about, you know, his thought process and going through how he kind of approached this kind of film. And apparently he used only instruments that were around at the time the 1600s, why it feels so haunting and kind of empty, which I thought was so interesting and so powerful, that they basically put so much effort into making this feel as authentic as possible, which is just incredible. I also love the film on like another weird level, which is that it's very empowering. You know, this whole film just kind of pressurizes on Thomasin, the oldest girl, and at the very end, well, I guess I shouldn't mention what happens at the very end, but basically there's a very empowering moment at the end of the film. And it's, I very much feel like it's actually a very feminist horror film.
It is.
Yeah, which I absolutely love, because it's, you know, when the movie's all about sin, and you know the family leaves their original home because their father's like, you know, it goes against the wishes of their actual village, and he's, you know, extremely hardcore. So there's a lot of it's based on sin, and you know it feels like at the end it's just this whole like relieving of all the sins and just kind of total empowerment, which I love about the film. But it's also just a really great thriller. It's totally engrossing in every way, and I just love it. I think it's such a perfect film, and I can't wait to see what he does next. Eggers. Yeah, that's me, The Witch.
Okay, so Hunter, your favorite one of the year.
Ooh. It's gonna be hard.
Billy Lynn?
No. hard pass on Billy Lynn. I'm gonna go with Arrival. Denis nice. Villeneuve.
Nice.
Yeah.
Denis Villeneuve.
I don't care. I live in Atlanta, dude. I get away with every mispronunciation.
Denis Villeneuve.
Villeneuve. Guys, I have a degree in French. Stop.
Denis.
Come anyways, down to Alabama.
It's a great movie.
Villeneuve.
Oh my God. It's me, a Nuevi. Back to the movie.
Oh God,
Hunter. It's Denis Villeneuve.
Remember, Anna, we're from the United States. Everyone speaks Spanish, so we pronounce everything.
Oh my gosh.
Como se dice Denis Villeneuve?
Como se dice water, Ben?
Okay, so Arrival is your favorite movie. Why? Why is it your favorite movie?
Dude, that movie was, to me, one of the most beautifully shot films I saw all year. Also,
Bradford Young. Mm-hmm. Bradford Young.
Dude, Bradford's amazing. I gave him a hug once in the rain, and I'll never forget it. But if you're listening, Bradford, you remember me. You remember me. There's no way you'll ever forget that PA giving you a hug because you thought that's what you wanted you to do in the rain. That was me. Anyways.
It wasn't.
No.
Continue.
It wasn't what he wanted me to do. He wanted me to hand him a director's chair so he could sit in it. And I thought he had his hands out because he wanted a hug. I was like, it's 5 in the morning. We've been up for 14 hours straight. Sure, I'll give you a hug. And I gave him a hug and he was like, well, that's cool, but that's not what I wanted. I just wanted a chair. I was like, oh, I'm real sorry about that. But anyways, that's besides the point. Arrival, I don't know, man. I just really liked it. I thought the story was fantastic. I had no idea what was going on. Like, I knew the story, like, what was progressing through the story, but I had no idea where it was going. And, man, it just really, really, like, I walked away from that movie, and I thought about it for weeks on end. And I still think about it, like, when I'm driving in the car. Someone will remind me of it, and I'm like, man. It's just, like, the power of that movie that story tells. That's something really rare, and it's something that I really appreciated, and I thought was really important in a year like 2016. Because it's, like, a political movie, but not political on the surface. And, I don't know, I really, I got a lot out of it, and I think people would, too, if they watched it. So, go rent Arrival when it comes out. Go see it in the theater, if there's some theater that still has it. But, yeah, phenomenal film. Really loved it. Okay. Also, Sicario was great. He's a great director. Prisoners was fantastic. They're right now, some of the people that I work with on Walking Dead are actually in New Mexico for the sequel to Sicario. No, Soldado.
He's doing Blade Runner. Next.
He's doing Blade Runner. Is he doing Soldado? Or is someone else taking
Soldado?
No,
I don't think someone else is doing that. He's busy doing Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Denis. Yeah. Denis
fantastic,
is doing Blade
fantastic.
Runner.
He's a great director. I was tempted to say Midnight Special only because I love that movie too, but I am gonna go with Arrival instead.
Will, how about you?
I don't have a favorite film of the year just yet in terms, I think, of the one I'd watch over and over again. We've mentioned a lot of them, especially La La Land, which For the best pictures that nominees that I've seen thus far, at least in terms of the sort of the big ones getting praise, that one's probably my personal favorite just of watching as a pure enjoyment. Arrival's a very close second. But the one movie that we haven't mentioned that I think is one of the best movies of the year by far, Hell or High Water is one of my favorite films of this year. It's a great Western. It's a revisionist modern Western. Everything about it is fantastic, from the acting performances to the storyline. Everything about it is great. If you haven't seen Hell or High Water, you need to see it. It's a great film, especially if you enjoy Westerns. And if Chris Pine, and again, I've talked about my sort of man crush for Chris Pine, and he needs to be a much bigger star than he currently is. This is another one of those great Chris Pine roles. And I think you will also find that Ben Foster, if there were any justice in the world, would get a Best Supporting Actor nomination, because he's great in this.
Spoiler alert, that movie is written and directed by Taylor Sheridan, who also wrote Sicario and Soldado. Also, I did not realize this until the other day, he played Sheriff Hale in Sons of Anarchy.
What?
Yeah.
Mind blown.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Dude, that's pretty cool.
Dude does it all. Yeah, he's going somewhere. He's pretty damn good. Gotta give it to the guy. Talented guy.
So my pick of the year so far. I haven't seen a couple of the movies we've talked about. Moonlight is one of the ones that I feel like I really want to see that I haven't seen yet. Arrival is actually another one that I have not seen yet. I'm gonna try to see it this week. So my current pick right now, my favorite thing I've seen this year or saw last year actually, was Fences with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis. And I think I talked about this before. I saw the play right after I graduated high school, and I thought it was phenomenal. And I was like, this is what acting can be. And I thought the movie was even better than the play. They were able to add moments that weren't in the play, because one of the problems with having a play is you can't really move around that much. So with the play, it was just in the back porch, and that's where the characters interacted. That was it. With the movie, they actually have to go inside the house or in the front yard or in other places, because Denzel Washington's character, Troy, is a garbage truck worker. You have to see him on the truck. And then a lot of just great silent moments that added to the relationships of each character. And Viola Davis is a powerhouse in the movie. Like, if she doesn't win an Oscar this year, I swear, I have no faith in the Academy after that, because I think she's phenomenal in it. Denzel Washington's great. Another one that no one's really talking about who's in the movie is Michael T. Williamson, who played Bubba in Forrest Gump, but I think he's a great supporting role as Denzel Washington's brother, who was in the war, World War II, and because he got shot, he has a metal plate put in his head. And so I think it's just a great role for all of them. And I think because Thomas had a reaction to Hacksaw Ridge this year when he like cried a lot. That was Fences for me, when I was pretty much like crying for the last half hour of the movie, and I thought it was phenomenal. So
all I'm hearing is there's a possible crossover with Forrest Gump.
Anyway, so that's the movie stuff. So briefly, we'll try to speed through this. I don't want to go too fast, but though, we lost a lot of people who passed away this year in 2016, kind of a sucky year when it comes to that. But I wanted each person kind of has a person they want to talk about, so we'll go into that. So, Anna, I'll let you go into your person that you want to talk about.
Oh, yeah. So, Anton Yelchin is one that shook me quite a lot this year. It's a tragic way to die as well. He's just was such an incredible actor. I remember watching Charlie Bartlett in whenever that came out, 2007, and just like totally falling in love with this guy. And he's just been incredible in every role. I finally saw Green Room recently, and it was just fantastic. And I finally saw Star Trek Beyond as well. I'm pretty late to those ones now, but it was heart-wrenching to see just such a talented person gone so soon. So Anton Yelchin will be very missed this year, for sure.
Have you seen Like Crazy?
Yeah, he's so great in that too. He's great in every role he's in.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the saddest ones I think of the year, just because he was so young and so talented.
And how it happened, it was just something that was a tragic thing. It was a tragic thing.
No, and I think he got. I remember reading that he got his notice for the Jeep recall like a week after his death.
Uh-huh.
Like, I know. I just like broke my heart to read that. Rough. Yeah.
Oh man.
Gosh, I know that was a really tough one. Yeah.
So Hunter, you're up. Your person.
Mine would be Prince. I was at work when he passed, and a lot of people that I work with were very, very big Prince fans. My mom was a huge Prince fan. I love Prince just because it's kind of what I was raised on. It didn't really hit me for a while, but his last performance was here in Atlanta. He did a 2 shows and 1 night performance that popped up like a week before. No one really knew he was coming. And after he passed, the Fox Theater, where he played his last performance, played Purple Rain every night for a week straight. And I went to one of the screenings, and it was really, it might have been my most memorable theater experience probably of the year. I don't know, man, it was just really sad, but also like just fun and like energetic, and everyone had a really good time. Everyone was singing and dancing. It was like going to a concert, but it was a movie. Never. I don't think I'll ever have an experience like that again. But yeah, truly tragic. Death also a little something just like to keep you smiling. Dude died in an elevator, and his lyrics, when the elevator tries to bring you down, go crazy. I honestly, like, part of me wants to believe that he knew he was going to die, so he just got on the elevator and was like, this is it. Close the doors. And that was it. He was just like, I'm going to troll my fans one last time. I mean, like, and it, yeah, it's just sad, dude. Just really, really sad.
Another song that kind of goes with that, not with, with how, with when he died, was Sometimes It Snows in April. And it was, it's from one of his movies he did, and it was like basically a song he sang for his friend's funeral, who died in April, and that's when he passed away, was in the month of April. So that's like a very sad song when you add that context to it. Now
it's poetic, man. He's a treasure and will be missed dearly.
Yeah. So Will, yours.
Can I talk about two? Is that all right?
Yeah.
So our last episode, or two episodes ago, when we talked about Rogue One, I know we opened the episode with Brandon talking a little bit about Carrie Fisher. So one of the things, though, that I loved about Carrie Fisher was her writing and just how entertaining as a human being she was, just how much fun she seemed to have with life, even as it wasn't necessarily the happiest of worlds, especially dealing with being bipolar. And certain, she kind of had a kind of a rough life, but she had a fascinating life, and she had an incredible, really interesting life. And of course, everyone's going to remember her for Princess Leia. Also, don't forget she was John Belushi's love interest in Blues Brothers, a role that no one really talked about that much, I don't think, during their obituaries.
My favorite movie of all time was the Blues Brothers,
and she's hilarious in that. I mean, just sort of the crazy fiance slash girlfriend. I mean, it was great, and. But the thing I will, the other person I wanted to mention sort of in conjunction is Debbie Reynolds. And now I first encountered Debbie Reynolds in a kind of an odd place. You might not be too odd for you guys. You might have had a similar experience. So it was actually Disney's Halloween Town.
Yep.
When she played the grandmother in Halloween Town. And my mother said, you know, that's Princess Leia's mother, right? I said, really? It's like, yeah. I said, oh, that's cool. And then I turned to find out, oh, she's a huge movie star. And then I go and watch Singing in the Rain. I was a little, when probably 12 or 13. I was like, this is such a great movie. And that's Princess Leia's mother. Oh, Debbie Reynolds. Oh, that's so great. And then watching her in Tammy, her other sort of big musical. And then, of course, her biggest role, the unsinkable Molly Brown, which she was up for an Oscar for, losing out to Julie Andrews for Mary Poppins, surprisingly. But... if you really, I think one of the best ways to truly understand how sort of special and unique and fascinating people both Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher were, you need to read, or if you can find on HBO, her one-woman show that Carrie Fisher did off of her book Wishful Drinking. Her performance from that is breathtaking. It's hilarious. It's poignant. And you really do get a sense and a feel and a respect for just how kind of bizarrely beautiful and wacky that her life was, and their whole connection with Hollywood royalty, and just the sort of the inside baseball of Hollywood in terms of stars and scandal. It really is. It's a great thing, especially if you're sort of a Hollywood nerd when it comes to sort of the golden ages, and that's a connection, and especially to have them both die within 24 hours of each other.
Yeah.
48 hours. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible. Like, it's a really sort of a bizarre happenstance, and I think they will both be greatly missed.
Yeah. Thomas, yours?
Mine is definitely, looking back at the list of people we lost this year, there are a lot of people who meant a lot to me, but the one who really sticks out to me on the list has got to be Gene Wilder. Gene Wilder's films, you know, especially his collaborations with Mel Brooks, were such a major, major formative part of my childhood and who I am as a person and my sense of humor and probably the reason I'm pursuing comedy right now. I don't remember the first time I saw Young Frankenstein. I was too young to even remember specifically the first time I saw it, but I've seen it too many times to count. I remember the Producers was one of the first DVDs that my family ever owned. We bought on DVD, like, as soon as we got a DVD player, we found it and bought it, and I watched that an endless amount of times. I was probably a little bit older when I saw Blazing Saddles, just because it had, you know, it had a different rating, and yeah. I think the first time I saw it was on TV, but that one as well, but really just Young Frankenstein, and especially knowing that Young Frankenstein was Gene Wilder's kind of passion project. You know, he only, the story that Mel Brooks always says was he only agreed to do Blazing Saddles if Mel Brooks would let him do Young Frankenstein directly after. And so that's just, I absolutely love that film. It's one of my favorite comedies, one of my favorite movies of all time. And to just know that is his writing and his humor and him working with the people that he loved and just playing this character that all came out of his head is just truly makes it, I thoroughly enjoy that film. And I went back to watch it like the day after he passed away, and it's an incredible experience to just come back to that film after having experienced it. And he himself, I have read a lot of interviews with him and seen a lot of interviews and you know his life that he led and his family, and just he was truly an incredible person. And to have, you know, the romance that he had with Gilda Radner and the friendship, the lifelong friendship with Mel Brooks, is just all, from everything I understand, he was a great person. And I was most sad to have lost him this year.
Mm-hmm. The person I want to talk about wasn't, credits wise, wasn't as big as some of the people we talked about, but it's was Gary Marshall. And Gary Marshall didn't do some of the best movies at the end of his career, with like Mother's Day and Valentine's Day. I have to bring those up. But he did things like Pretty Woman, which is his big thing. But he also helped create Happy Days. Or actually, he was the creator of Happy Days. And the big thing about Gary Marshall was that he helped kind of discover a lot of people, or he gave them kind of their first kind of breakout role or whatever. So with Happy Days, he cast Robin Williams to play Mork, and what ended up being Mork and Mindy, and Mork was Robin Williams' first big role. And then he got Julia Roberts into Pretty Woman, and that kind of made her a star. He did a movie called Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks when he was very, very young, and that was Tom Hanks' first big kind of dramatic role, and kind of dramatic and comedic. And then he did, what else did he do? Princess Diaries with Anne Hathaway was her kind of her first movie. Princess Diaries 2 had Chris Pine in it, and that was his first movie. So he was kind of known for kind of discovering these young talents. But the main reason I wanted to bring him up, because I told this story on Facebook when he passed away, was that a few years ago when I was visiting LA for a class for University of Alabama, we were on a tour at Warner Brothers. And we were at like lunch. It was kind of the more executive tour, whatever, like because it was a bunch of Alabama kids coming to LA for the first time. And we're talking, and the tour guy goes, "Hey, that's Gary Marshall sitting back there behind like four tables back." And everyone goes, "Who's Gary Marshall?" And I'm like, "How the hell do you not know who Gary Marshall is? This is your major." And I start listing off stuff. I go, "Oh, I don't know those." And I'm just like, "Oh my God, guys." And what happens is someone comes over to our tour guide. The waiter comes over to our tour guide, takes the tour guide away. The guide comes back and he says, "Hey," he goes, "Gary Marshall wants to come over and speak to you all. He found out you were film students and he really wants to meet you." And
that's awesome.
So when he finished his lunch, and he walked, he when he got done, he walked to our table. And he's like, "Hi, my name's Gary Marshall. I've worked on a few things." And he didn't really name much, but he's just like, I heard you guys are all film students. Where are you from?" And we're like, "Alabama." He goes, "Oh, Alabama, Roll Tide." And very nice. And then he says, "Do you guys have any questions?" And I'm like, I'm not walking away from this table, or not letting him walk away from this table without asking a question, even if it's just like just a stupid, like, generic question. It was like, I said, I love Happy Days. I love Nothing in Common. What's some of your favorite stuff that you've done, your projects? And he started talking about that. And no one else asked a question. And then he thanked us for letting him stop by and talk to us during our meal. And just a wonderful man. Everyone I've heard talk about him has great stories to tell. And like, he didn't have to come over and talk to 21-year-olds who, like, most of them didn't know who he was. But he gave his time and came and talked to us for 10 minutes just to help us out in some way. And I totally respect that. And I have to acknowledge that. So yeah, that's kind of a downer way to kind of towards the end of this. But so briefly, what's some stuff we haven't mentioned for the year in 2016 that was great or bad? Could be music, could be anything. Just real quick.
We lost. I also want to make a quick shout out to Alan Rickman, because that really hurt watching, going back to my diehard tradition at Christmas. But there were some really, really incredible losses in music this year that spawned some really beautiful albums, both with David Bowie's last album and Leonard Cohen's last album. They were both dying as they recorded it, and it made them very, very just harrowing and beautiful pieces of music. And then also I was really two other albums that were kind of about dealing with music were A Tribe Called Quest's latest album and Nick Cave, his album after losing his son in 2015. So yeah, it's all really dark when I look back. I recently, for a friend of mine, I put together a list of my favorite albums of the year, and looking back, I was like, wow, these are some really, really dark albums, but they're all kind of beautiful and tragic. Mm-hmm. And then Coloring Book is so optimistic and an incredible album, and that's my favorite of the year, so there you go.
By Chance the Rapper, in case none of you have, if some of you haven't done, listened to it. Anna, do you have anything that we haven't mentioned?
Honestly, I think you guys have covered all bases.
Which, yeah. I think this is a two-part episode now.
It would have to be. Yeah. Well, we didn't talk about Harambe. Managed to get past that.
Praise be to Harambe.
Yeah.
Okay.
We almost got through the second hour of this. Yeah. Rest in peace, sweet prince. Come on, Anna.
But we couldn't let it 2016 pass without mentioning Harambe. I mean, oh, man. That was a big deal. Anyway. Apparently. You guys have mentioned the important ones.
Hunter?
No, I think that pretty much covers everything, yeah.
Well, the one thing you didn't mention that was on your list that you can talk about really quickly, X-Files reboot.
Dude, that was garbage, and it was a waste of time. The Kumail Nanjiani episode with the guy from What We Do in the Shadows was mm-hmm. hilarious, and that was probably the only good episode. It reminded me of like an old-school, feel-good, have-fun episode of X-Files. Like, It was trying to set up this new like group of agents that are terrible and have no screen chemistry, and I just thought it was terrible, and it was garbage, and I was let down, and I don't know what I hate more, that or the OA. Hunter out.
Hunter out. Okay, well, so thank you guys for coming on. Big thing for you listeners, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, write us a review, give us some ratings so we can hear what you guys have to say about the show. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at @CineNationShow. Make sure you like us on Facebook. You can also email us at CineNationPodcast@gmail.com. Our big thing right now is Medium. We have a lot of great articles. We've had a lot of big followers, especially after Anna's Die Hard video that she did. So if you haven't seen that, go check it out, of how Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Thanks, man.
So yeah, you're welcome. All right. I think that's it. We're closing the book on 2016. Thank God. So that's over. Guys, thank you so much for coming on, especially Anna and Hunter, because it's now after midnight there where you're at. So, guys, thank you so much. Hope you guys listen to more episodes. Bye.